I'm in the studio now with Jim Gregory. And Jim, you have a new CD out called The Hanging of Tom Brown. And I got to tell you, Jim, that was an amazing listening to your double CD. And it just happens to be Black History Month, but you know, it's such a powerful story, you don't want to relegate it to just one month. And it was a story about your involvement in the civil rights in this country. Now, you didn't set out to be a civil rights activist.
No, not by a long shot.
You're from Tennessee.
Right.
You had a school bus that you converted into a classroom. Were you a hippie?
I don't know if you would call me a hippie or not. I rode a motorcycle and I just tried to do what came naturally. I guess I was kind of a naturalist. I don't know. But I enjoyed life on the road and got bored, I guess, after a while in college. And a friend of mine and I decided to put together this bus. And due to an experience that had happened to me in 1958, I decided that I wanted to see if I could help some people. And we decided to try to collect textbooks and go around to Black schools and give out textbooks and maybe help teach kids to read and write. Because I've always felt that education was the key to freedom.
And you're from Tennessee, so was this your home that you were trying to do this?
Yeah, well, I was in college in Athens, Tennessee, at Tennessee Wesleyan College. And most of my friends were, of course, out of Chattanooga on Lookout Mountain. And so we decided to head out and try to see what we could do in Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia. And we just went from one school to another. Frequently, a school would recommend another school in another community, and we would go from one school to another, to just trying to give out books. We collected books, discarded books from school systems in Athens and Chattanooga and Knoxville and other large school districts. We had pretty much a busload of books, and we would leave them with schools.
This is late 50s, early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah. We started this out. I started college in 1959 at Tennessee Wesleyan, and by 1962, I was really kind of bored with it and didn't want to live on campus anymore. And I had some problems in the college. The only thing I really enjoyed out of the college was the Tennessee Wesleyan College Choir, which I sang in. And then when the choir director left and I kind of dropped out of the choir, it seemed like the road called.
Now, your mission to teach and to share stories and sing songs with uneducated rural people, you didn't think this was a radical thing. This wasn't something that was anti-establishment you were doing.
No, I was. I spent from grades 3 through 5 in California. And white people were the minority in the schools I went to. And so when I came back to Tennessee, I just kind of thought that that was the way everybody wanted things to be. And, you know, they had separation of everybody. But when I ended up in Mobile and ended up in jail in Mobile after a sit-in that I didn't realize I was part of, I got an education as to what this separate but equal actually meant. And that bothered me for a number of years. And so I felt like it was necessary to try to help people better themselves. And so that was why I got started in it.
Jim Gregory is here in the studio, and he has a new CD out called The Hanging of Tom Brown. And what's interesting is that this was like a hidden memory of yours. It was listening to your story, a new double CD. It's a very painful time, not only in America, but you personally. Right. And so I understand how it's not easy for you to bring these memories up. In fact, these memories were hidden for a long time.
They sure were. There was a total of 8 people on the team, and in the course of the travels, 6 of them didn't make it. And I was always taught that if you lead somebody into danger, you don't walk away. Well, me and one other guy, I'm not sure we walked away. We were on crutches, so we kind of limped away. But we did make it out. And that bothered me.
You think being white was the reason why you made it out?
Maybe being white and Southern. I could walk the walk and talk the talk. I was kind of, I made part of our money by shooting pool and kind of redneck bars while we were doing this. We didn't get many contributions from churches or anything, but
I assume people thought you were one of them. You're a redneck.
They just thought I was a redneck biker coming through the country, and so I made a good deal of money for us that way shooting pool, but I kind of was able to, as I said, walk the walk and talk the talk, but four of us were actually from the South. Four out of the eight, we were actually Southern.
Were you the only white guy?
No. Everybody was white except one girl.
I see.
She joined us after we'd been on the road for almost a year, and she was probably at that point in my life the prettiest girl I'd ever seen.
Was this your fiance? Is this the woman?
We ended up getting engaged not long before Selma, and of course nothing came of it because she didn't make it.
She didn't make it. The story gets revived in 1976 because mm-hmm. you're here in South Florida. You're a high school teacher. You're showing a documentary.
It was 87.
Oh, 1987? Oh, mm-hmm. okay. 1987, you're showing a documentary during Black History Month mm-hmm. of the famous march that Dr. Martin Luther King led from Selma to Montgomery, 80 miles march. You're watching.
Actually, it was 54 miles. That's a mistake I made.
Oh, you made it? Okay.
Because we were on Highway 80, and I don't know whether the number stuck in my head or not, but I thought at first, it's on crutches, it seemed like 80 miles.
But that 54 miles, you were with the marchers, and you mm-hmm. marched that on crutches.
Right.
It should be noted, too, you were on crutches because you were indeed tortured in jail.
Mm-hmm.
You were injured by police officers while you were in jail. And you saw yourself in this documentary, not knowing you were there, and it sparked all these memories came back to you.
Yeah, I just kind of blurted out in class, that's me, and that's Billy. And my kids in the classroom went, what? What are you talking about? You know, what do you mean that's you? And so I ran the film back to the frame that showed us. There was only a few frames that showed us in the march, but it really hit me hard. And I was able to talk to the kids. I wouldn't tell them the stories that I told on this CD. I just went ahead and told them about what people went through. So it was really something that broke it open for me.
You were told, and while you're in jail, you were told never to return back mm-hmm. to Alabama. Yeah, you took part in that march.
Yeah.
What went through your mind? Was there any doubt about you taking, well, you first of all, you were on crutches, and you had 50 miles to march.
Yeah, well, of course there was doubt. There were many times along the route. In fact, one time Mary said, don't you think we've done enough? This was before we ended up in Selma. She said, don't you think we've done enough? Maybe we ought to go home. And there are many times I wish I had listened to her. But May and I both were against it. And the rest of them kind of went along with it. So I guess I talked them into staying, but as a result, all but two died. And that has weighed on me for a long time because I just felt like it was my fault.
Again, it doesn't seem like America. You had officials threatening your life and also taking the life of your mm-hmm. of your coworkers.
Well, it ended up at one point after we were after Dr. King came to town. They knew that Dr. King was coming to town, and so they took us out of jail and took us, the four of us, in four different directions and dumped us. And they put me through a thing where they tied me to it. They took off my handcuffs and tied me to a tree. And I heard, they had me blindfolded, and I heard the guys cocking guns. And I thought, I'm dead, you know. But when they pulled the triggers, they fell on empty chambers, and I kind of lost it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But after the beatings, I don't know, I probably felt that being dead would probably be a relief. But that was before the march actually took place.
Jim Gregory is here. So you did take part in that march, and the people that you were working with, they're now martyrs. But, you know, I'm so glad that you came out with the story because their memories will be remembered now because you're bringing this to light.
I hope so. I, I, I got prevailed upon to tell the story by four really powerful storytellers. The main one was a guy named Doug Lipman. And Doug heard me tell the story of the hanging of Tom Brown, just that portion.
Well, tell me, who was Tom Brown?
Tom was a guy that came to the first Freedom School that we set up in Mississippi. And I actually learned how to teach reading by teaching Tom. He was an older man who came and said, I want to be able to vote. And so we worked with him to try to teach him because he had to pass some rather severe tests. The voting requirements in Mississippi and Alabama and many of the other southern states at that time required a very strict test. And, of course, the people who were giving out the voter registration cards were pretty much paid to turn them down. So we knew we had a fight ahead of us, and Tom worked hard enough that he finally was able to pass the test. And within a couple of weeks after he got his voter registration card, he was found hanging. And
nobody knows who did that.
No. The sheriff said it was suicide, and no, it wasn't suicide.
Is he one of the six people that you refer to as your friends?
No. He's our first main success story, basically. The six are the six that were with me all the way.
So those are the ones you actually feel responsible for,
right? Yeah,
for continuing on with the march at. So you're teaching high school now. Oh, you're retired now.
Yeah, I'm retired now. I was teaching middle school at the time I saw the CD or the tape.
I find it interesting how you decided to get a college degree and become a real teacher after this whole incident, and you couldn't even get a job.
Because... No, for 4 years after I got my teaching certificate. Every time I would apply, I was told that every time I would apply to a school, two FBI agents would go into the principal's office and tell him, you don't want to hire him, he's a dangerous radical. So, I don't know, maybe that's some kind of notoriety, I don't know.
But I don't know. Was that just in Tennessee or Alabama?
Oh, no, I applied at schools all the way from Florida to Alaska, and couldn't get anything. Every time I would talk to a principal, they would seem to be happy and they seemed to like what I said, and I would think, wow, okay, I finally got a job. It wasn't until Nixon resigned that evidently his list went with him, and I got a phone call, that girl that I had met. I'd been substitute teaching a bit, but this girl says, you still want to be a teacher? And I said, yeah, I do. And she says, well, maybe you need to, you know, clean up and apply. At that time, I was in pretty bad shape. She says, you need to clean up and apply. And I went down to school in southern part of Hillsborough County, East Bay High School, in south of Tampa, and applied and got hired. And I taught there for 7 years before I ended up coming to Miami. And I've been here for 32 years.
Jim, I know you because you are a storyteller, mm-hmm. Very active storyteller. Do you still do the open mics?
Still do as much as we can. We tell stories first and third Sundays at the Grateful Bread, which is a beautiful little bakery on 125th Street, not far from the Luna Star.
But when I first met you, this was not part of your personality. You were telling fun stories, singing fun songs.
I tried for a long time not to tell this story. And if it hadn't been for Doug Lipman and some of the others, I never would have told it.
Do you think it? I know you were. You've since I've known you, you've lost a tremendous amount of weight, and mm-hmm. I just found out you also had a cardiac arrest,
congestive heart failure, and a stroke.
Does this free you up at all? Do you think holding this in had affected you?
A lot. Yes. Now that it's out and it's published. For instance, this coming Wednesday, I'm appearing at the Holy Cross Lutheran School in North Miami. I'll be there at 1 o'clock, and I'll be there as long as they want me to stay and answer questions. But I'm going to be talking to the kids there because kids today don't understand what went on back in the 60s. They have no comprehension of it. And they need to understand where their history is, what happened as a result of all these people. They need to know that the martyrs weren't all black. You know, there were a lot of white folks that were there helping, trying to, you know, staying in the background, but trying to help. And when we went to Ohio to get ready for the Freedom Summer in Mississippi, they tried to discourage us from being a part of it. They really, SNCC, the organization that had put it together out of Howard University, didn't want white people involved. And it hadn't been for May, we probably would not have been able to do it. But she talked them into it.
Being extremely dangerous for white people to do it.
Evidently. Well, they didn't think white people would understand well enough, would understand the problems of the black culture well enough. They did everything they could to discourage us from going. They had on mock attacks, things that, you know, we might get attacked by mobs and things like that. They did everything they could think of. I'm trying to recall a name. Maybe it'll come to me a little later, but I heard a man speak there who I referred to later as the soul of the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King was the face of the movement, but this man was the soul of it. And he's still in Florida. This man's in Florida.
Did you actually meet Dr. Martin Luther King?
Yes, I did, but at the time I didn't know it. I had seen his picture. I'd seen, you know, I kind of had an idea of who he was. But while we were on the march, Billy and I were at the first camp, the first night we were at the camp, and we'd been walking all day on the crutches. And our feet had been bandaged. We'd had a couple of weeks to recover, but that hadn't been enough time to really get our feet in good shape.
Because the police, they tortured you in jail.
Yeah, well, I was, and they kind of delighted in beating the bottoms of our feet with rubber hoses. This was kind of a thing they enjoyed. And we were sitting on a log, and three men came up, and I heard this one man says, "Here they are, doctor." And I thought, doctor? And this guy comes up and he has a little camp stool. He opened up the camp stool and set it out. And he says, "Bring me some hot water and a medical bag." And so they showed up with hot water and they had what I took to be an actual doctor's bag. And he took off the bandages off of her feet and he cleaned her feet and he put salve on them and rebandaged them. And then he started telling us that they would make arrangements for us to be at aid stations and have our feet checked, you know, all along the walk. And when he left, I turned around to Billy and I said, "Isn't that nice of them to send a doctor over to check our feet?" And there was a guy sitting on the other side of me, and he says, "Man, don't you know who that was?" I said, "He was a doctor, I guess." And he says, "Yeah, Dr. King." And I felt about an inch high.
Jim Gregory is here, and your story, The Hanging of Tom Brown, it was just released. It's
yes.
Brand new.
Yes, it's available on, of course, Amazon and iTunes and CD Baby and Google Play now. Of course, it's also available from me. I keep a few copies around. I'm going to be at Mount Dora the first weekend in March for the Florida Storytelling Association, and I'll be introducing it there.
How do you feel about sharing the story now after all these years? Do you still feel it's part of you?
It was a release. It was like somebody said, you know, what was wrong with you is you had what could be the equivalent of PTSD, and by getting the story out, you've released it. It's allowed you to live again. And I think maybe that's probably true. I don't want to put myself in the same category as our soldiers and people who have been in Iraq and Iran and Vietnam and all that. I've never seen battle like that. But the civil rights movement was a war. People died, and people died, as far as I'm concerned, without reason. And a lot of these people I knew. Many of them I didn't know, I came to know through studying about them. Jimmy Johnson, there was him and his mother and his grandfather, who were attacked during a demonstration, and he was shot in the stomach, and later died in the hospital. In fact, we got arrested the night that we were having a memorial service for him at this little church where we were working. And it was outside of Selma, but since we were still in Dallas County, the deputies were the people who came and got us. And that's where two more people died and the bus got blown up.
The bus was blown up with two people in it.
Right.
That's just, it's as if you were at war, Jim. It sounds mm-hmm. like it was a battlefield here in America. It was just a really incredible story. I thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a CD now. Are you going to write a book with it too?
Well, I don't know about whether it's going to get long enough to be a book. Right now it's only about 80 pages. I would have to go back and try to dredge up more memories. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I could do it. I have, though, there's a man who's a well-known storyteller named Antonio Roca, who called me yesterday and advanced the idea that he would like to see it turned into a screenplay. And so maybe something will happen in that direction.
Jim Gregory is here. And Jim, your website's jimgregorystoryteller.com.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you can be seen at open mics. And the CD is available at the jimgregorystoryteller.com.
Right.
It's an incredible story, Jim, and I really appreciate you coming in and sharing it with us and sharing it with everybody, really.
Well, I'm glad you brought me in, Michael. I really appreciate it.